This is Orson Welles speaking. A motion picture in which I play a part was scheduled for a couple of days running last week in Aiken, South Carolina. But the film was banned. Well, I'm used to being banned. I've been banned by whole governments. The Nazis in Germany have banned me, and the fascists of Italy and Spain have banned me. Here at home, the merest mention of my name is forbidden by Mr. Hearst to all his subject newspapers. But to be outlawed by an American city is a new experience. The movie in question is neither controversial nor obscene. But I am in it, and for the taste of Aiken, that makes any movie too offensive to be endured. Not only was the actual celluloid driven out of the city limits as with a fiery sword, but in defense of civic sensitivities and to protect the impressionable of Aiken's youth from the shock of my name and likeness, a detachment of police officers working under the direction of the city council itself solemnly tore down such posters as the local theater manager had been rash enough to put up by way of advertisement and burnt same, together with all printed matter having reference to me, in a formal bonfire in the public streets. I'm also informed that I've been somewhat less officially hanged in effigy. And while I have an apology to offer Aiken, it's been suggested that I would be ill-advised to deliver it in person. Since I brought to your attention the case of Isaac Woodward, the case has grown into an issue of the most heated popular concern. It deserves all the national interest it's getting. Isaac Woodward is the veteran whose eyes were beaten out of his head by a policeman in the streets of a place in South Carolina that Isaac Woodward thought was Aiken. He said so in an affidavit, and when I read his affidavit on this program, the mayor of Aiken, the chief of police, and others, subsequently preoccupied with the public burning of my name and picture, sent affidavits of their own protesting innocence. My problem was the choice of affidavits. The boy had been blinded. That was the one clear, brutal fact, and I stuck to that with a promise to Aiken's officialdom that I would apologize for publishing the veteran's testimony when and if my investigators could show a decent doubt. The records were amazingly brief. The policeman who delivered Woodward to the hospital was not named. This is most unusual. The place where the attack occurred was not mentioned in the report. This is almost unheard of. But my investigators, the investigators of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People and the investigators of the FBI, have together narrowed down the search to the town of Batesburg, some 19 miles from Aiken. And this morning comes word that the search has been narrowed still further. I have before me wires and press releases to the effect that a policeman of Batesburg, a man by the name of Shaw, or Shore, or Shull, it is given three different ways here. The flash is just before us. Chief L.L. Shaw, pronounce it however you wanted, or want to, has admitted that he was the police officer who blinded Isaac Woodward, 30 miles from Aiken. In South Carolina. This is in Batesburg. I'll give you a few more of the facts. He has corroborated an army statement, has Police Chief Shull or Shaw, that ex-serviceman Isaac Woodward Jr. was struck on the head with a blackjack. Chief Shull or Shaw says he was called to a bus one night last February to arrest Woodward, who, and I'm reading from a press association, he said was drunk. Shaw claimed to have hit Woodward across the head when Woodward tried to take away his blackjack. He added that the blow may have landed in the veteran's eyes. Shull or Shaw, the police chief, described the eyes as swollen the next day when Woodward was fined in the recorder's court and said he then drove Woodward to a veteran's hospital at a doctor's suggestion. Now, you'll remember from the affidavit and from further reports of our investigators that Woodward said he'd been offered liquor after he was attacked by the police, which he refused. And investigators of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored Peoples have discovered three other occupants of that bus, all of whom claim in affidavits that Woodward was not drunk, nor was he drinking. Woodward, you remember, appealed for medical aid. And also, according to the UP, Shaw, brands these stories as lies. He has volunteered no information for this. He was unearthed by investigation. Well, the good citizens of Aiken must be surely so glad to hear this that my apology tendered herewith and as per promise, most abjectly, will come as merely incidental comfort. Batesburg, unlike Aiken, has turned out to be to blame. The search is narrowed down. We're getting close to the truth. We have the admission of a man that he was the officer whom I call X. Well, I would like to remind Officer X, otherwise known as Shull or Shaw, of another promise. Promise I made to the blinded Isaac Woodward. If Chief Shull or Shaw is listening to me now, and it's more than possible that he is, it gives me pleasure to repeat that promise. Officer X, we know your name now. Now that we've found you out, we'll never lose you. If they try you for your crime, I am going to watch the trial, Chief Shull. If they jail you, I'm going to wait for your first day of freedom. You won't be free of me. I want to see who's waiting for you at the prison gates. I want to know who will acknowledge that they know you. I'm interested in your future. I will take note of all your destinations. Assume another name, and I will be careful that the name you would forget is not forgotten, Officer Shull or Shaw, police chief of the city of Batesburg. I will find means to remove from you all refuge. You can't get rid of me. We have an appointment. You and I. And only death can cancel it. Our scene changes now to the sovereign state of Texas. They're holding a little election. They held it. We're so close they're going to have a runoff. It's nothing important. It's just a governorship at stake. It's nothing to be excited about. It's just whether we're going to have a democratic education and freedom in Texas or not. It's nothing to be concerned about. Just a matter of who will control the Democratic delegation from Texas, the next Democratic National Convention. Of course, there's some people in Texas who are excited. Old Jesse Jones and the oil interests are very head up. So are the railroad people. They've poured $500,000 cash onto the barrelhead. They want to elect a man they can trust. The man they can trust is named Buford Jester. He's the railroad commissioner at the present time, so naturally the railroad people are backing him. Old Jesse Jones hates Harry Truman and Henry Wallace, so he doesn't want Jester's opponent, a Truman-Wallace man, to win. On the other side of the fence is an avowed New Dealer, Homer Rainey, Dr. Homer Rainey, who knows wherever he speaks. He was president of the University of Texas just a little while back when the big money boys ganged up, knocked him out of his job. You remember there was something very close to rioting among the students, but Rainey's out. So now Rainey is running for governor with money still piled up on the opposite side of the fence. Mr. Jester is spending money in great lumps, and herein hangs a tale. One of the mediums Mr. Jester is using is a recently organized public relations and advertising firm named Watson Associates of Dallas, Texas. I have a photostat of the registration certificate of Watson Associates filed with the county clerk in Dallas, Texas on March 14, 1946 at 3:06 p.m. It shows that the first name listed of those who swore they will conduct the business of Watson Associates is that of a very interesting gentleman, name of Philip E. Fox of Dallas, Texas. Now, I am particularly interested in Mr. Fox because of the fact that he is now one of candidate Buford Jester's advisors and aides. And if Mr. Jester becomes governor of Texas, he'll give a lot of power to those who helped elect him. So who is Philip E. Fox? Philip E. Fox is an ex-convict. Now, there's nothing necessarily wrong with that. Everyone is entitled to a fair chance. But Mr. Philip E. Fox was convicted of a crime which, for the moment, I'm not permitted to name on this radio program, but I promise to name it next week when I can show the lawyers gathered here my proof for the contention. Philip E. Fox was convicted of this nameless crime on December 22nd, 1923, in Atlanta, Georgia. Even that is forgivable, perhaps, although it isn't usually considered very nice to have ex-cons and convicted, I can't name the crime, working for you in a political campaign. But there's one more X about Philip E. Fox of Dallas, Texas, which interests me even more. Philip E. Fox is the former publicity director of the Ku Klux Klan. Philip E. Fox was editor of the Klan's official publication, The Nighthawk. In fact, the murder for... excuse me, I should never have said that word. For which Fox, it is claimed, went to jail, involved his shooting an attorney for an opposing faction of the Ku Klux Klan. This is the same Philip E. Fox who was vigorously assisting in the campaign to elect big money Buford Jester as governor of the sovereign state of Texas. I thought the voters of Texas might like to know about these things. Well, scene changes again. This time it's Washington. And we find ourselves in the Statler Hotel on the 9th floor. Clean, cool room. A phone is ringing. The man who rented the room has just opened the door when he hears the annoying rumble. He answers something like this. Yes, Morris, this is Dash Dash. I'm just back from the State Department. Of course, I'd be glad to tell you all about what happened. Sure, come on up. The speaker was one of the 6 American members of the Anglo-American Palestine Commission. He hung up the phone, turned to the newspaper man who'd come upstairs with him and swore bitterly. Those poor, miserable people, he said, having to duck around corners all the time, pleading for information like they live behind barbed wire. Why does the world have to be like this? Why must the fate of millions of people be settled in star chamber proceedings? Why are those striped-pants diplomats so determined to reduce the Jews to the status of second-class citizenship? And the newspaper man sat there coldly in the hotel room, a little cynically. He'd heard visitors to Washington talk like this before, but rarely with such bitterness. And the citizen-turned-statesman was mad clean through. He resumed his outburst. You know, there were 10 of us sitting in that room. There wasn't a Jew among us, just the acting Secretary of State, Dean Acheson, Henry Grady, the 2 men just back from London who tried to sell Europe's Jews into the partition ghetto in Palestine, and we 6, the American members of the Anglo-American Commission. It was ghastly the way the State Department tried to rationalize it. They were looking for an out. We 6 men had spent 3 months studying the issue. 6 Englishmen appointed by the British cabinet were also on the commission. We were unanimous in our findings. We agreed perfectly. Even the British went along on every single point. That's how obvious the Palestine situation is. We all went to London together. We heard weeks of testimony here. Then we went to Palestine and heard the Jews tell their story, and we heard the Arabs tell their story, and we were still unanimous. Now the State Department, fawning over the British Foreign Office, is trying to sell us out. Man settles down in his chair, lights a cigarette. Newspaper man takes notes. The voice continues. One of the members of our commission is Billy Phillips. You may have heard of him. He's been a diplomat for years, a State Department man for decades, but he's an honest man. He was an ambassador until recently. He was an ambassador to India and minister to London. When he heard the British Foreign Office proposal, he was violent. When he heard we were thinking of accepting it, you know what he asked? He asked, "How long, Mr. Acheson, does the State Department plan to continue as a tail of the British kite?" "Of course, this is all off the record," concluded the news source. "Of course," replied the newspaper man. "Of course," says Orson Welles, who got this story from the newspaper man. "It's all off the record. Let's let the people sell the people for oil. Let them sell people for alliances and bases in the Middle East, of course. But let's keep it off the record. I wonder if we should." The word from Paris is unhappy. More of that next week. I think I have just time for now to read you a letter. Before I do, I'd just like to make this comment about international organization, though. I do think that we ought to stop giving up hope every day when we read about what's happening in Paris. I think we ought to realize that the best hope for international organization, the way the world is run nowadays, is the separate, selfish need of every nation for world peace. We mustn't expect a shiny, ready-made millennium in our time. "Well, here's the letter, dear Mr. Wells. Some women would bake you a cake or knit you a necktie, but here's a poem. And it's from Dorothy Littlewort, who I see lives in Buffalo, and I liked her poem, and I'm going to read it because I just have time for it. It says, for Orson Welles. There is no cozy warmth about this shame, as one might feel who shyly blushed at praise. There is a bitter, cold, consuming flame, a knowledge we must live with all our days. I lift my lamp beside the golden door. I hold these truths to be self-evident. There is no incantation will prevent the murder of a black man or restore to him his pride or give him back his sight. Words are but pebbles on a homemade sling against this wickedness, but I will fling them ceaselessly with all my little might. It is some comfort that your arm can bring the broadsword of a champion to the fight." Thank you, Dorothy Littlewort, for that poem. Thank you for letting me read it. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for letting me join you. And please let me join you again next week, same time, same station. Until then, I remain, as always, obediently yours.
This is ABC, the American Broadcasting Company.